G'day Australia, world investors, at crypto goers and economists. I'm Adam Stokes. Welcome back to the channel where I am again joined by Martin North. Martin, thanks for coming on tonight.
Hi, good to see you again.
Martin, I've been looking forward to this episode for some time. We're talking about philosophy tonight. Now, as I understand, your background is actually as a philosopher.
Yeah, I have to say that my academic training was as a philosopher, and I nearly went into academia having spent time at Oxford, but chose to sort of use those skills elsewhere, and they've actually proved to be very, very valuable. And people sort of throw their hands up in horror and say, philosophy, what use is that? Right? But actually, the secret to understand about philosophy is that it's what's called a second-order science. In other words, rather than thinking about things directly, you're thinking about why things are the way they are. So you ask the next question and the next question. So there's a lot of why questions, and you're trying to get below the surface to understand what's really going on. And actually, you can apply those philosophical skills to any activity, whatever it is, whether it's finance or whether it's some relationships or, you know, whatever it is, politics, because the same fundamental precepts and concepts just bring everything into sharp contrast. And so I've been able to use my philosophical training in all the things that I'm doing more recently.
I've got to admit, during school, I can't actually remember ever doing philosophy as a subject in a class. Maybe it did happen sometime during the years at university or school, primary school, high school, and I was asleep during those lessons or periods, but I don't remember it ever happening. And as I got older, I spent many hours binge listening to Philosophize This by Stephen West. And one of the philosophical questions on that channel was, is philosophy dead in modern times? And in your opinion, are there modern philosophers and is philosophy dead?
Well, it depends a little bit what you mean by philosophy, right? Because here you go, I'm now philosophizing about philosophy, which is a recursive analysis just gone mad. But look, philosophy can cover a whole range of different things. And frankly, there's a very broad church of philosophers from one end through the other end. I think a lot of them, frankly, go around in ever-decreasing circles and disappear up where, you know, wherever. But nevertheless, the fundamental questions that philosophy can get to are really, really important when you apply it to other things. So my view is that if you think of philosophy as a pure science, it can become pretty much a dead end. But if you apply the techniques and thinking of philosophy to other situations, other life events or whatever, it can be really, really powerful. And that's how I tend to use it.
Well, let's explore, I guess, some of Plato's work, and that being the frame of reference. So we'll go into an example of a table. So if we look at what makes a table, and we apply that to a frame of reference, how do we bring that over to our space in the modern time and probably in our work, working with money, economies, real estate, and so forth?
Yeah. So I wanted to start with Plato because, you know, obviously he's right at the beginning of the journey of philosophy, but he had some really interesting things to say. And one really good example is, as you say, when you think of a table, right, and I'm talking here about the piece of furniture, not a table of figures or whatever, right? Think about what makes a table, right? Because there are certain things that you cannot say. You can't say a table's got four legs because a table can have one leg and it can still be a table, right? You can't give it a specific size because you can have a big table or you can have a table designed for a doll's house. They're both tables. So the interesting question is, what is the essence of a table that defines it as a table compared with a chair or another piece of furniture, right? What is it that makes a table a table? If you stop and think about that, it's actually really quite hard to actually come to a determinant of what it is that makes a table. And in fact, the answer is, it's a table because there is a set of rules and conventions that we have relating to certain parameters around a table that determines it's a table. So if somebody else looked at that same object of furniture but didn't have the same basic understanding and assumptions about what a table was, they might call it an elephant. And it would be no wronger or righter than our definition because it would just be a different frame of reference, right? And so when you come to this, it comes back to everybody carries around with them a whole bunch of rules and a whole bunch of inner assumptions about how the world works. And that's necessary because evolution basically means that you can't spend all of your time in every situation starting from first principles because you'd be dead, you know, before you got there, right? Therefore, it's inherent in being alive is that you carry around of a model, if you like, of the way the world works. All of these assumptions about the way the world works, right? But they are assumptions. They may not be right, they might be right, right? And what's interesting is if you actually meet somebody who has a completely different frame of reference, they can actually use language which is the same but means something completely different. So, for example, somebody in a different world could actually determine not a table is a table, but an elephant is a table, just because that's the rules they've got there, right? So that's the key point. There's a set of rules, assumptions underpinning. And in fact, Plato, he sort of said, look, imagine you're sitting in a cave and what you're doing is you're seeing a shadow of things going past, right? And you get some essence of what it is that you're seeing, but you don't really see the full thing. In fact, he argued that there's an ideal table out there somewhere that would actually determine all of the characteristics of a table. But the point about the cave is you see a shadow, you see some of it, right? But you don't necessarily see all of it. And that's the key point. So your frame of reference is critical. You'll get a flavor for various dimensions. It's an assumed set of rules for the way that the world works. And everybody carries that with them all the time, wherever they go, whatever they do. And what a philosopher is doing is asking questions about that frame of reference and trying to bring it to light and say, what are the assumptions that you've made, right? And I'll give you just another example, going back to the elephant, right? If you think of an elephant, what determines an elephant as an elephant, right? You can't say it's alive because you could actually have a stuffed elephant and that would still be an elephant, right? You can't say that it's three-dimensional because you can have a picture of an elephant and that will still be an elephant. So what is it that makes an elephant? Think about that.
Well, it's you make me think about when I was actually in a past life teaching safety. So when, first of all, it was OHS, then it was OHS and WHS, as these laws have evolved, one of the things I used to always teach was there's no such thing as common sense. And the example I give, I guess, is with the frame of reference, is that if you and I from the Western world walk up to a power socket and stick a fork in that power socket and turn it on and electrocute ourselves, it's fair to say that you and I lack common sense. However, if you take someone with our same age and, I guess, biologically same intelligence from a culture that's never seen a power socket, and also with a frame of reference, certainly what I've got from philosophy is time periods. So what might seem right to you and I in this time period might seem completely wrong or vice versa 200 years ago. And so it's quite easy to look back at, I suppose, gender studies is one example. Looking at gender 100 years ago, it's like, well, that was pure evil what they're doing. Well, relative to those time periods and the paradigm during that time, maybe it wasn't so evil. But going back to the safety analysis, if someone from a different culture sticks that same fork in the same socket and flicks a switch, yes, it was probably silly, but do they lack common sense? And I don't think it's fair to say that. Equally, if we were to go to their culture and, I don't know, pat an animal. I remember when I was in the Middle East, someone pat a desert fox. Like they got access to what was seemingly a friendly desert fox. And they had the paradigm of, in Australia, you can pat what seems to be a dog and it'll be okay. Well, this person was treated for rabies and it was a very invasive treatment. And many people were saying, well, that person is lacking common sense. But of course, it was just the frame of reference.
And that is exactly right, right? So everybody goes around operating within a particular frame of reference that determines the way they think the world is and determines the behaviour which is acceptable versus not acceptable. And they will extrapolate from what they know when they meet new things and will assume that what that new thing is going to do is going to be extended from their current frame of reference, right? But as you say, it could well be that that frame of reference is actually completely out of date or completely wrong in a different environment. Therefore, you've got to learn it all over again. And that's part of the challenge of because it's quite tough to change and identify those implicit assumptions, because they are implicit. They're not surfaced, right? But everybody carries them.
And language is really powerful when it comes to this. So I learnt my first, second language, if that makes sense, when I was 18. So when I was 18, I moved to Spain for a year. I did a year at the University of Barcelona. And through learning a second language, my paradigm on so many things opened up so widely. And it wasn't simply, you know, saying bottle is this word. And in my second language was Korean. And that changed my paradigm again. So as I went onto my third language, it was almost like my mind opened up further. Now, many times when I was learning a second and third language, I made many Western assumptions into what I was learning. And I remember one time I was in Pamplona, the running of the bulls, and there was a individual there who was a local who was giving me a beer, and we were having a good time, and he said, "Puta madre," which is in direct translation is mother effer. And I thought he was insulting me, but although in that was in direct translation, and we nearly got into a fight as young idiots, but he was just saying, "Oh, this is really good." And that direct translation, I actually failed, or in that instance, to understand that word for word, it doesn't always translate directly. And I realized that this guy was actually being really friendly, just as we are in Australia. And sometimes if we insult each other, it's not actually out of hate, but it's more out of love. And that was certainly a frame of reference I learned, I gained from learning other languages.
Yeah, and that's the key point, right? So you can actually have a set of words strung together in a particular way, but unless you understand the frame of reference that informs that particular string of words, you can completely misunderstand what the intent is.
You can see in diplomacy how wars can be created from simple misunderstandings of intentions or words or body language even, which I guess leads us to the structure of scientific revolutions. You were speaking about a book by Thomas Kuhn. What did you get out of that book?
Well, yeah, of all the things that I read, and I read a lot, this was the one that really stood out for me. And in fact, he introduced the concept of the paradigm shift, which of course has become almost, quoted probably too often. But the book basically said, look, got to understand how science actually works, because the previous assumption was that science was a sort of an evolution that built on the previous generation and the previous generation. It's sort of everybody stood on everybody else's shoulders, right? But what he said was, no, actually, if you look at the way things work, essentially what happens is that on day one, you have a particular worldview that everybody occupies, and they basically defend that view as far as they can. They might test it and do their thing, but they defend the view, right? But what then happens is that sometimes you start seeing evidence and alternative views beginning to sprout, and the mainstream becomes effectively resistant to those new ideas because the worldview that they occupy doesn't conform with the worldview implied by the new things that are being developed. And he said that over time, what happens is there's a tussle between the old way of thinking, the old paradigm, and the new paradigm. And quite often, the new paradigm gets snuffed out because essentially the weight of society and the weight of the existing opinion is strong enough to basically hold the existing view together. But sometimes you get a flip and suddenly everybody jumps across to the new worldview, and then that new worldview becomes effectively the standard way of thinking about the situation. And that revolution can happen very quickly, right? And that is really, really important to understand, because what it basically says is there is a set of rules and assumptions that everybody works with, and generally you work within that. And you will tend to reject ideas and information that goes counter to your current view of the world. Some people, however, are able to begin to see that maybe there is an alternative way of thinking, and that alternative view maybe is worth exploring. And sometimes you then flip, and suddenly everybody then adopts the new view. And you could argue, you know, flat world versus circular world, you know, or spherical world is one example of that, I guess. But it's also true wherever you look. So if you look in economics, if you look in science, if you look in politics, everybody goes around with a worldview, right? And every time they come up against a worldview that's different from their own, they will reject it. That's a really powerful idea.
And Socrates, one of his famous quotes is, when the debate is over, slander becomes the tool of the loser. And we see that quite often. I think, unfortunately, certainly when we have public speakers coming to modern universities now, instead of even allowing the debate to commence, the slander begins and violence it rises from certain political groups before the debate even occurs. And it's something that I've been quite concerned about as I've, I guess, moved through the Western world and noticed that a lot of debate is being shut down. And I'm kind of striving, I hope, for the highest level of being. And we speak about the three levels of being, you know, that you have the lion, then the camel, and then the child. And when we're young, we're fighting everything that's in front of us, and we're fighting our way through the world, and especially through adolescence. And then as we become adults, we become the camel, where we're carrying all the burdens of the world on our shoulders. And many people stop at the camel and just stick in one paradigm and don't achieve the highest level of being, which is the child, free of discriminations, free of hate, open to learn different perspectives, and certainly the ability to learn. We see children pick up many skills so much quicker than the camel, the adults who are stuck in this paradigm. And most certainly as we move through life and we strive to be the child, I hope to see in the West a space to have greater debate that seems to be shutting down.
Yeah, it is very, very interesting that we are now in a situation where it's almost unheard of to question some of those frame of referential things that I've spoken about, right? In other words, if you start pressing on that particular, good example, right? Climate change, big, good example, right? If you start pressing on climate change, and I've seen on my channel, if I start talking about climate change, I get more negative comments and people saying, you don't understand, than almost anything else, right? Never mind what my view might be. Even to debate it, even to talk about it, is seen as, you know, beyond the pale. I think that's really, really worrying and very concerning, because it seems to me that a mature society should be effectively an environment where ideas can be explored and tested, and different concepts can be, you know, held up and looked at, and, you know, maybe right, maybe wrong. But just because somebody over there says, no, that's not right, I refuse to debate it or touch it, right? Your worldview gets narrower and smaller, and you end up essentially creating a more isolated view of what's actually going on. And that is what's happening at the moment. You can see it on the internet, you can see it through social media, and you can see it in the mainstream press as well. And essentially what it means is that rather than actually becoming, as you say, more mature and more open to new ideas, effectively people are getting narrowed and squeezed and compressed into a narrower conforming worldview. And that conforming worldview is one that often reduces freedom rather than actually increases freedom. And it stops debate and it stops the ability to explore rather than actually encouraging it. And I think that's a real, real concern.
Yeah, I'll put it out there as well, Martin. The other one, climate change, might be one, but most certainly, dare I say it, gender. Even just saying the word can send up so many flares to create so much passion and so much hate. So we certainly won't get into a gender discussion, but it is an example that even if you just try to speak about it, as we see in some universities and mainstream media, the violence, literal violence that erupts from it. And I guess we refer to Stephen Covey's seven habits of highly successful people. One of the habits he refers to is really seeking out the other person's opinion. So I like to think of diversity as not color or gender or religion, but diversity in thinking. Yep. So I don't really care what you look like or what you identify as. I really appreciate the diversity of thinking. And as Covey talks about, he says, I really seek your different opinion. I actively seek your different opinion to make me smarter. Now, it doesn't mean I have to adopt your opinion, and it doesn't mean I even have to accept it. But just the sheer ability to hear that opinion creates a space of immense maturity and growth and the ability, I think, to become smarter.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the DFA channel, for example, what we try to do there is to bring different opinions to the table, right? You won't always find everybody with the same view, and that's okay, because I believe that having an exchange of different views and opinions and ideas, and you listen to other people, you may learn something, you might accept it, you might reject it, that doesn't matter. But remember that what I said, everybody is carrying around with them all the time a particular frame of reference that defines the way they think about everything, right? And the challenge that I set myself, and perhaps people watching these shows as well, is to, one, understand what your frame of reference actually is. What are your implicit assumptions that you're actually, you know, worrying about but not worrying about, because they're just there, right? And secondly, be open to the fact that you do have a frame of reference and a set of assumptions, but those assumptions are assumptions. They may not be 100% right. And therefore, if you actually start interacting with people with different opinions that actually can be compelling, your worldview can expand and change to accommodate them if you let them. But so many people close it down.
I think it's fair to say, Martin, that you practice what you preach, because without putting words in your mouth, but certainly from the video that I watched, your last one that you released, where you were speaking to someone from the crypto world,
yeah.
And that I'm originally from the crypto world when it comes to YouTube as well. I think it's fair to say that you're not a huge fan of crypto. I think you understand it. And please stop me if I'm paraphrasing poorly, but I don't think you're as big of a fan of crypto as I am. Is that fair to say?
I think that's probably fair to say. I do understand it.
Yeah.
But what I try to do is to let people have their head on it rather than me trying to lead the debate all the time, right? So that's essentially the difference.
And that's what I'd like to acknowledge with what you're doing. And certainly what I've noticed in the crypto space as well, and the money space and the economic space and the financial space, is that these vigorous debates take place. So Peter Schiff is a traditional banker who's big on gold and big on investing. I don't like his opinion, but I really enjoy when he debates with the crypto community, because he comes forth. He's very respectful. He opens up and just has a debate saying, this is why I don't like crypto. And the crypto community comes back and says, well, this is why we do like it. And both put forward really good debates. And I really enjoy the debates with Peter Schiff, because he's not backwards about coming forwards, but he's so respectful in the way he does it. And I remember in one of the debates he did recently, well, actually, it was probably about a year ago, he took on a very prominent, very smart YouTuber and crypto goer and a founder of a crypto company. And they had a big, open, public debate in front of a crowd and published on YouTube. And it was fantastic, because these two men were completely opposed to one another, but they just both presented really good arguments, and the crowd created the space where this could happen. And when we relate to what happened, I guess, with Socrates, when he was putting forward an opinion, and for whatever reason, he was, you know, basically killed. He was poisoned with hemlock that I believe he had to drink himself. Do you think that as we move through the world now, people are forced into modern suicide, and that being silence through intimidation and science, and silence through scare tactics?
Well, I think there are three things going on. I think the first is that many people are distracted by day-to-day issues and never get a chance or even have a desire to explore some of these second-order things that we've been touching on tonight. Because, you know, life is too short, I'm struggling 9 to 5 or whatever, you know, whatever it is, right? And a lot of people on my channel say, well, there are a lot of people out there who should really understand more of this, but, you know, people, particularly in Australia, are just not interested. They prefer to go to the beach. So there's that sort of first level motivation. But secondly, I think you're also right that there is a cone of silence which is descending on many discussions and in many communities, because it's not seen fit to discuss things. And, you know, it's somehow held out as essentially, if you discuss that, then you must believe a particular doctrine, and therefore, if you believe that doctrine, then, you know, a whole bunch of things follow from that. And unfortunately, that is a real worry, because the more the cone of silence descends, the more the echo chambers of social media get narrower and narrower and smaller and more atomized. And of course, the algorithms that all the social media companies use will tend to cluster people into smaller and smaller communities of like-minded thinking people. That's a worry, right? Because essentially there's no way to then actually get the countervailing point of view, the alternative argument. And I'm a great believer in looking at all the arguments and all the different perspectives. I think the third thing to say is that particularly at times of discontinuity, and I'm thinking here of the potential financial crisis or property crisis or whatever it is, people then grasp for simple truths and watertight answers when there are none. And that's the third thing to understand, that the more you question your frame of reference, the more you understand that it's relative compared with other people. There is no absolutely 100% right or wrong to a particular point of view. That can be really disconcerting at a time when people are looking for certainty. And, you know, I'll give you an example of gold or crypto, right? People say, well, in the current environment, you know, the financial situation being so wobbly, I want to put my money somewhere safe. So I'll put it in crypto or I'll put it in gold, because I'm told by various people that either of those are actually the safest thing to do, right? And unfortunately, people get sucked into those particular simplistic solution sets without understanding what they're getting into. And so at a time of uncertainty, people grasp for these straws. And I'm very concerned about that too. So I think that's some of the dynamic that's going on at the moment.
Yeah, Martin, you and I are obviously into money and talking about economics, money, real estate and so forth. Mm. And our worlds have come together ironically through a common cause. Initially, our worlds came together, I think, through the cash ban. I saw you speaking with Robbie Barwick. I also interviewed Robbie Barwick. And I'm relating this to postmodern philosophy from Hannah Arendt. And I want to talk about her philosophy of the banality of evil. So Hannah was speaking about, she basically analyzed after the Second World War, how did the Third Reich rise and how did it become so evil? How were they put in this position? And one of the people she put on trial was Adolf Eichmann. Now, during the trial of Adolf Eichmann, they were trying to find this SS officer who was high up in the German military. How did he become so evil? What was so evil about him? And what they actually found during the trial of this man, that is, in fact, quite scarily, he wasn't, in fact, he didn't seem to be an evil person. That is, it seemed that he was simply doing his job and doing what the culture around him was doing. Now, what we found in this philosophy of Arendt is that true evil can be carried out by those just doing their jobs, trying to survive and get a promotion. Now, I draw a long analogy with the banking sector. And of course, this is an extreme example. And I'm not suggesting that the banking sector by any means has any relation to the to Hitler or to the Third Reich. But what I am suggesting is that this extreme example of the emotion that I get from some of my comments with respect to the banks. So the hate towards the banks for some of the things that seem evil from the banks. Now, my probably number one mentor, who I hope to meet one day, Andreas Antonopoulos, and when I say he's my mentor, I just study him virtually. He speaks about when he was working in the banking sector. Now, many people are talking about bankers being these evil people. And I draw the analogy of Adolf Eichmann, where many people were saying, well, he was an evil guy. Now, what he did from an administrative point of view, basically looking at numbers on a piece of paper, and those numbers were, in fact, people that he was sending to death camps. He was essentially, and I'm not defending this man, but he was essentially just doing his job. Now, when we translate this to the banks, what Andreas Antonopoulos was saying is that these people aren't evil. They're just part of a system. They're part of a culture, and they're part of this machine that is, as we can see, taking steps through quantitative levies and cash bans, negative interest rates and so forth, which may be damaging to the people. So when it comes to banks, in your opinion, are they inherently evil? And if they are, how do we break this system of damaging economies and people?
No, I mean, I think the concept of evil is not right. They have a particular worldview. Going back to this frame of reference, they have a particular frame of reference within the within which they operate, right? And it's if you think of a banker is there in terms of making maximizing profit to shareholders. Well, that is actually what capitalism is about, really. To do it, essentially, the culture of the organization will tend to orientate around a certain set of behaviors which are there to maximize returns at all costs, despite the fact that in the process you might well be damaging consumers and small businesses in the process, right? And then the Royal Commission last year showed that the culture of banks in Australia, almost universally, are actually aligned around a set of parameters that are profit-driven at all costs, right? That's the worldview that's been propagated inside those organisations for a long time. It's the culture of those organisations. It is the frame of reference within which they operate. Now, my argument is banking doesn't have to be like that. There is actually an alternative frame of reference that you can still make returns to shareholders, but you can do it on the back of maximising the benefit to customers and building brand loyalty and all those things. But that's a different world from the one we've got today. So that's at one level, right? If you come up another level to economics, to what central banks are doing at the moment, right? Central banks around the world are trying to still deal with yesterday's problem, the 2008 financial crisis. And they are effectively using a sense of a set of rules and a set of assumptions which I think are flawed. It goes back to their frame of reference is a relatively strict, logical economic view that is very myopic, in my view. And as a result of that, what we have is a set of behaviours amongst central banks and flowing down into the political environment, like the cash ban and those things, which are actually completely alien to the interests of genuine, real people. And yet, the people in authority and the people in power in the central banks, because of their frame of reference that they're operating in, can't see that that's a problem. And it's a trade-off they're prepared to make. So I keep coming back to call out the implicit assumptions that the central bankers are actually making, right? Because unless we actually question the implicit assumptions that they are making, the politicians are making, you know, the Reserve Bank are making, they will just go forward and basically continue to propagate their particular worldview, which I don't think is right. But if you start questioning, and now we've been doing this on the DFA channel, you have as well, if we start questioning those assumptions and we start laying bare the implicit assumptions they're making, then there's a chance of policy change. And that, I guess, is in essence what we're about.
The crypto community has an who am I to speak on behalf of the entire crypto community, but essentially the culture, I think it's fair to say, in our cult, in crypto culture, is that we've given up on the banks. We've given up on the banking system, and we offer an alternative. And ultimately, forgetting altcoins, looking at Bitcoin in its purest sense, that no one owns it, completely decentralized, anyone can get involved with it. It doesn't discriminate against anyone, noting that, I guess, up to 2/3 of the world's population is unbanked, where some people can't even walk into a bank because they don't have shoes, as an example, and they won't let you through the front door, particularly in second and third world countries. Bitcoin doesn't care about shoes. Bitcoin allows everyone to be involved. Bitcoin doesn't need papers. Bitcoin doesn't need anything. It's completely non-discriminatory. And that, I think, is where in the crypto community, we actually look for an alternative to this banking system. But I certainly acknowledge that on the other side, and I got this actually from Robbie Barwick, and I got a lot of, I actually had a beer with him in Canberra when he actually was coming down to look at some of the parliamentary hearings here. And I told him that one of the things that I got out of his conversations was that he said during our interview, he goes, "Don't give up yet." And I found that really powerful. And I kind of picked that up from you as well. That is, don't actually give up on the banking system yet. Don't give up on the financial system yet. Don't give up on our government yet. And I'm trying to remain impartial. I'm trying to remain the child. I'm trying to remain open to everything. And I see this great passion to maintain integrity in the banking system and the federal system and the government system. But I also see, as a crypto goer, this incredible opportunity we have for a new way, noting that we've had this evolution of pretty much every technology that we've seen, certainly in our lifetime, but no real evolution in money itself. We see crypto as being an alternative to the current system, which will lead me to a philosophical question that I haven't prepared you with, but I want to get your opinion on it. This philosophical question is this, my friend. What is value?
Right. Well, yeah, you see, the point about value is that you can't define value in a vacuum, right? Because you could argue that, you know, friendship has value. You could argue that somewhere to live has value. You could argue that money has value, but all of those three forms of value are very different, right? I think what we have fallen into the trap of is a very narrow view of value. And if I translate that into, for example, the way that the economy is measured, it's measured in GDP, which is effectively activity, right? And that activity, increasing activity, is defined as creating more value. I don't think it's true. For me, real value is measured on rather different things, which is actually benefit to society and benefit to individuals. And if you start going down that route, then you'd want to measure the economy differently. You'd want to actually understand that the financial system and the political system is there for the benefit of individuals and communities, not for the perpetuation of their own reason for being, right? That's how I think about it. So I'm also with you saying, you know, never give up, because there's always a chance that we can actually take the trajectory down a different route if we get enough of an understanding of what's really going on, which is going back to the frame of reference. And with regard to the Bitcoin thing, there's two comments. The first is, you're assuming everybody has a device and everybody is connected to the network, right? There are many, many parts of the world where that's not true, and that's a limitation, I think. The second one is, you've got to understand how the Bitcoin world interacts with the central control, central bank control, and those, that tussle will go on for a long, long time. And the question is, will it be Bitcoin or the equivalent of Bitcoin, or will it be the central banks that ultimately win over? My own sense is it's going to be an uphill struggle for Bitcoin to be able to actually maintain a separate, discrete trajectory in isolation from financial systems and banking systems in their entirety. I suspect we'll see a more morphing and emerging of those things, but then it goes back to, will it be central bank digital currency based, or will it be Bitcoin based? And that battle, my friend, is one that's going to take 5 to 10 years to work out.
Yeah, and when we look at it at the time paradigm, whether it be beads, shells, feathers, stones, gems, diamonds, gold coins, they in many instances are relative to the time period. And as we transition into the future of money, we often say in the crypto space that we're already using digital money. And I can support this entirely with, once we have the cash ban in place, if it's in place, which we hope it's not, but that will prove my point. We're already using digital money. And then as we evolve from that, is that, do we want to use a federal, a centralized entity's money, or do we want to use
you mean legal tender?
Yeah, well,
because that's what you're saying.
I would actually argue, what is legal tender? And I'll give an example of this as in a philosophical opinion. I've argued this many times on my channel. So the nation of Australia issues sovereign tender to me, and then I go to the nation's shopfront, which would be a government shopfront, and I have a rates bill or a rego bill or any bill that the government has given me, and I say, here's cash, and they say, we don't accept that money. So I would actually argue philosophically is that, what is sovereign tender at the moment, noting that the government that issues their own money in many instances won't accept their own money, which pushes us into this banking sector where we have to go through a centralized non-elected third party, and we have to use their money, where they're taking a cut, where they can control it. So my kind of argument is that we're already in the digital space, we're already using digital money, and governments are already taking steps to ban all money, and we can see it's already happened with shopfronts, government shopfronts, not accepting their own money. But of course, this is a debate for another night, Martin, and I've really enjoyed this, and I think we all need to step back and be a little bit philosophical in our thinking, whether we're left, right, up, down, male, female, old, young, black, white, whatever the difference is. If we can just step back and strive to be the child, I think we can learn so much more from everyone.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, just to underscore it, everybody, remember, everybody has their own baggage, their own frame of reference, right? It's sometimes really good to stop and ask yourself, what are your implicit assumptions that are driving the particular thoughts that you have and the actions that you have? Because you learn a lot by even going through that process.
Martin, you've mentioned before in our videos some of the references to your, I guess, financial links or financial sites and analysis of what you do in the money space, real estate space, economic space. Have you got any such thing in the philosophical space?
Well, I'll send you a couple of links, because there are a couple of articles, and there's one specifically in The Guardian quite recently that mentioned and, you know, went through the Thomas Kuhn thing. I'll send you a couple of links, because it's quite interesting just reading some of what people say about these particular thought leaders. You know, there's a whole bunch of philosophers I could list out, but I'm not going to. But I would recommend the Kuhn book. If you really want to give your brain a really interesting workout and an uncomfortable read, but an important read, it's actually quite an approachable book. It's worth doing that. And I'll just mention one other. There's another book which I'll also send you a link through, which actually is covering something called self-deception. And that's the other thing that I studied at university, was how can you hold two views at the same time which are completely contradictory and still maintain effectively an equilibrium? And the answer is yes, you can. And a lot of people today, I think, are being self-deceived. In other words, they really know X, but they actually behave as though Y is the truth. And so Thomas Kuhn for the frame of reference and the paradigm shift, and this other thing for self-deception, would be the two things that I'd recommend as things to explore.
I'll certainly leave those links below on my channel. For your viewers, my name is Adam Stokes. Please join me on my channel as well. Martin North, I've really enjoyed speaking to you yet again. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Good to talk to you once again.